Amen. Amen. Now it's about time for me to wrap it up here. I've had a wonderful morning, and again, check me out every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. to 8:30, right after the Gospel and More program. 30 minutes here at KBOO 90.7 FM. Also, you can stream at KBOO.FM. And this little tune is a little tune called High Praise. I'll check you guys out next week, okay? Keep the faith.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. as the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time, presents By the Dawn's Early Light by Lawrence Block.
This is a case that shouldn't be in the first place, and I'd love to clear it up before they even go so far as presenting a bill to the grand jury.
So for me, you want?
Whatever you can find, Matt. I don't know what there is to be found. But you were a cop, and now you're a private. You can get down on the streets and nose around.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. Gremlin Times 3D Radio Players present an adaptation of Lawrence Block's short story, By the Dawn's Early Light, right here on Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Often associated with the 1960s counterculture, the use of entheogens or psychedelics has come back and is now being legally scheduled and studied for healing properties. But as our guest today shows, there has been a long underground use and study of psychedelics by women dating back to the time of the Eleusinian mystery schools of ancient Greece. Our guest today is Rachel Harris, PhD, author of the new book, Swimming in the Sacred, Wisdom from the Psychedelic Underground. Rachel was a psychologist in private practice for 35 years, working with people interested in psycho-spiritual development. During a decade working in research, Rachel received a National Institutes of Health New Investigators Award and published more than 40 scientific studies in peer-reviewed journals. She has also consulted for Fortune 500 companies. She has previously authored another book on entheogenic experiences called Listening to Ayahuasca. Hello, Rachel, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Hi, Paolo. Glad to be here with you.
Well, why don't we start out by asking, what's the sense of the book's title, Swimming in the Sacred?
Yes, that's a wonderful question. The Swimming in the Sacred is a phrase that comes from a song that Maria Sabina would sing. She was a Mexican curandera who worked with what she called the Little Saints, magic mushrooms. And there was an article written about her in Life magazine in the mid-50s. And she would sing during the ceremony. And the song was, I'm a woman who swims in the sacred. And I thought it was a perfect description of the women I interviewed who have been working underground for 20, 30, 40 years.
Okay. And you know, I want to know what motivated you to conduct the interviews and to write this book. I mean, I know you have experience with ayahuasca because we interviewed you about the other book.
Yeah.
And I also have experience with ayahuasca. So It's you're very experienced at that, but were you identifying with psychedelic guides or thinking that, you know, they were some kind of therapist like yourself?
Well, that was a mistake I made. I did think they were therapists, and they are absolutely not. This book came about sort of organically. Because of the ayahuasca book, I met a number of these women, and right. they had never talked to anybody. They'd never revealed themselves. They had a vow of silence. And so because they knew me from the other book, and we had also been around in the late 60s in the Bay Area, they were willing to trust me and talk to me, but I'm the first person they talked to, and I never asked them if I could record them. I just took notes. I just felt it was just too precious for me to have a recording, and just too dangerous. They continue to work underground.
Of course, because it's illegal to do what they're doing in most states. But were you wondering whether you should do it yourself, whether you should become a guide? I mean, early, before you wrote the book?
Right, because I was in many of the same places. I knew many of the people they apprenticed with. I was certainly very interested in psychedelics, but I'm personally, here's more confession. You said my book had a lot of confession in it. I'm full of fear. These women are afraid of nothing. So they've taken all the entheogens at all levels of dosages, small dosages, high dosages. I don't do that. I asked one of the women about the dosages, and she said, oh yeah, the lower doses, you remember more, you can bring more back, but I like to fly. Well, I would never say that.
Well, do you think that their relative fearlessness is the result of having done so much?
No. I think they were like
just
before.
That way.
Yeah, it's just
right.
Group of women.
Okay. Well, what is the impact of tripping that much? And what has it been like for you? How many times have you done ayahuasca?
Well, it's 15 years, so I don't know the number.
Right. Okay.
It's a trial for me every time. I'm not any better than at the beginning. But I love the after effects. I love the fluidity in my brain and the sense of healing. But it's not a fun medicine. It's challenging for me.
It's not a recreational drug.
No,
that's for sure.
No, it's a bathroom drug. You really need a bathroom.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm curious, why women? Why not include men in this? Or are most sitters, or what they call sitters or guides, are most of them female?
No, there are plenty of men as well. And many of the women apprenticed with men. But I felt that the women had more intuitive relationships with the medicine. And I was particularly interested in that kind of perspective. And I had talked to some of the men working underground, and they didn't seem to have that same personal, intimate relationship with what I called unseen others, ancestral spirits, plant medicines, the plant teachers of the entheogens. It just felt that the women had a special relationship.
Right, but as you point out in your book, that you have maintained some level of skepticism about these relationships with plant spirits.
I do. I'm a tough nut to crack on this. So you can see I'm also not in the same realm that these women are in. I have a Western scientific background, and it's a leap for me, but I'm making progress. I do feel a more openness about other realms of reality.
Well, I mean, if you're a scientist and you want to, you know, be totally scientific about it, I mean, wouldn't you just consider things like ayahuasca or LSD to be drugs, you know, that have an impact on your brain chemistry rather than something that, you know, gives you access to some mystical level of experience?
Well, I'm not that much of a materialist. I mean, I've had mystical experiences all my life. I think that's one thing I had in common with these women. And people who have been lifelong searchers and lifelong explorers, often they had unusual experiences as children, and that they've kind of followed those experiences almost like stepping stones.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's
you can understand
okay.
that.
Yeah, I can understand it totally. But it is kind of hard to explain the mystical. What's a mystical experience? You know, somebody could say it's brain chemistry. You know, maybe it's serotonin or I don't know.
There's a lot of mystery. Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. I mean, we hardly understand how the brain works as it is. If you make the point in the book that, obviously people take entheogens because they're positive about, they have a positive attitude towards change, and perhaps they're expecting or hoping that it's going to have an evolutionary impact on their consciousness and their, self-awareness and self-development. But you say that change is not inherent in the drug itself. Can you explain that?
Oh, yeah. I was just with a friend of mine who's on one of the study teams at a university, and we had an encounter with somebody who, we came out of the, and this is someone who's been using a lot of the entheogens, and another professional, and we came out of the encounter saying to each other, you know, if someone's a jerk before psychedelics, they can very well be a jerk after psychedelics. And right. We have to remember that. Psychedelics are not a miracle cure. There's work that needs to be done. And the women underground have really worked on themselves their whole lives. And with the medicines, with psychotherapy, and with all kinds of consciousness raising and spiritual approaches. So this is really an integrated part of their whole life and throughout their whole lifespan.
Right. You know, you make the point throughout the book, and I love the book, by the way, Rachel. It's fantastic. It was really fun, a fun read. I did think it was interesting that most of the women that you interviewed, and they're all anonymous, most of them are anonymous for good reason.
Oh, no, all the underground practitioners are anonymous.
Right. But I thought it was interesting that the majority of them had been apprenticed to males. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And then you make a point in the book that this is kind of a dying breed, that they're dying out because, you know, psychedelic guides now are kind of, you know, cultivated in a kind of a scientific reductionist way. They might not have even ever taken the medicine themselves. They don't
have
the richness of experience. But why do you say it's a dying breed? I mean, why can't they be apprenticing people coming up, you know?
Some of them do have apprentices, but they started in the 60s and 70s, and they spent maybe 6 years or so working on themselves. And then toward the end of that 6 years, they began to work with other people. So the new breed of psychedelic therapists are taking online courses, and they want to work right away. They're licensed therapists. So it's really a different category of people, and they're not going to spend 6-7 years working on themselves with these medicines.
But they're therapists, so they have, I mean, most people who become therapists or, you know, psychotherapists have done work on themselves, maybe not with entheogens, but
no, not necessarily, you know. There's no requirement that they have their own therapy, so it's totally up to their personal decision. Now, I happen to know a handful of good solid therapists who are really pursuing entheogenic experiences in this country and in countries where it's legal. And they are really digging in deep and working on themselves and also apprenticing with some of the elders. And I have high hopes for them. But, you know, most of the so-called psychedelic therapists are quite inexperienced.
You would think that having a background as a psychotherapist would be an advantage or a benefit to somebody who did cultivate their psychedelic awareness.
I fear you're giving my profession too much credit. There's nothing like experience. These are very unusual realms, and it really takes personal experience to have a feel for where somebody is going. And you know what's fascinating to me is these women, as I said earlier, they're not therapists. And a few of them, too, maybe, trained with shaman. But they're really priestesses. But now, uh-huh. on the research teams, we're asking guides, sitters, psychedelic therapists, to be therapists, to do the pre and post therapy support sessions, and also to be the sitter. So these are two different jobs, two different functions, really mm-hmm. requiring two different sets of skills. And so this is a whole different breed that we're looking for.
It seems to me that if somebody had their own personal therapist as their guide, that person would be able to maybe be more helpful when it comes to integrating the experience afterwards. That's been my experience. I actually have a therapist who it does psychedelic guidance and has encouraged me to go to, you know, Costa Rica and take uh-huh. Iboga, and you know, I've and she's been extremely helpful to me in terms of like integrating my experience. And I don't know that the average sitter.
Have you asked her how much entheogenic experience she has?
Oh, she's got a ton. She has a lot.
The difference. Well, yeah. Lucky you. That's what makes the difference. I want a therapist who has a ton of experience.
It's very expensive. It's a lot more expensive than your normal guy. You and I have talked in the past, you know, and it's like, I'm a little bit bolder than you when it comes to, like, I took ayahuasca twice just all by myself. And so just, you know, and you were shocked to hear that.
Yes,
and,
I'm still shocked.
But it probably wasn't as good for me as if I had had just an average sitter with me, you know, as a kind of a touchstone or a grounding influence. I'm not going to recommend it to anybody, but I've had so much psychedelic experience in my youth. You know, I took LSD, 80 times without any kind of guidance. So I'm not that afraid of the disillusion of the ego, which is something that you talk about in the book.
You're very experienced. Yeah. Let me just put in a word for the shamanic experience with psychedelics is that the healing is in the shaman singing. It's not in the
so-called. Yeah, see, I don't get that at all.
Evidently not.
I don't think it's that's the trappings, the cultural trappings. I don't think it's that important. I've never been to Peru. I've never, so I'm kind of a renegade. I like the singing and I like the music and that kind of thing, but I never gave it any kind of magical power in my mind anyway. But okay, so let's talk about that. You know, let's talk about why do so many guides claim to have relationships with plant spirits? In fact, you say the relationship with plant teachers is at the core of the entheogenic shamanic practice. Tell us about relationships with plant spirits.
This is true not just with ayahuasca, but with the other medicines as well. And some of the women talked about even having a relationship with ketamine, which is clearly just a drug. But that there's some kind of presence that comes through the medicine experience that they feel related to. And I think this arises out of experienced use of traveling in other states of consciousness and sometimes encountering entities where a relationship develops. And the women are very receptive to support from the plant spirits or the ancestral spirits. They have relationships that they can sense and experience even without the medicines present. So this is a whole other way of being in the world that we in the West are not, we're not used to this kind of thing.
For sure. Yeah. So, you know, how can you make the point that a relationship with a plant spirit can potentially help heal attachment issues from childhood? Can you speak to that?
You know, I've been saying that for over a decade, and I just printed out a professional article that talks about it. It's because when I interviewed people for the ayahuasca book and the original research I did on ayahuasca, this is how people talked about their relationship with the spirit of ayahuasca. I can call on her anytime. She's always available to be support. I feel like she wants what's best for me. Sometimes she might be a little harsh, but I know it's for my own good. And she's always available. So you begin to hear, these are attachment statements. This is how people talk about a good parent.
Right, right.
And so, you know, when, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that's the way some religious people relate to Jesus or God.
Yes, yes. The people who have coffee with Jesus in the morning. That's an attachment relationship.
Right, okay. And that's probably a good substitute for an insecure attachment with a parent.
That it's very healing. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the cynical people would say, well, okay, you have an invisible friend, and isn't that great? It makes you feel better. But, you know, these are mysteries, like you said. It's like there's no way to prove anything. It's experiential. And I've experienced it too. You know, I always thought of ayahuasca as kind of a grandmother figure. Uh-huh. And it made me think of my grandmother, who was a source of unconditional love in my life. Now, you say that there's certain personality types of women who become guides, that they score high on the personality factor openness to experience.
The personality factor is absorption.
Absorption. Okay. What is absorption?
That they're very well. It's a measure of the scale. The Telligen absorption scale is a measure of hypnotizability, and if you score high on it, it means you are a good hypnotic subject. So what it means in terms of enhanced states of consciousness is that you're very fluid. You can move. You can shift states of consciousness with great ease and fluidity. So, and if that's so for you, then my hypothesis is that you need a smaller dose. You don't need a heroic dose to break you out of, you know, this world and put you into an altered state. And so I actually score high on this. So one of the manifestations of that was if I was, some of these interviews went on for days. And so after 10 hours of talking and chatting and going for a walk and having lunch, I would have sort of a contact high. So you get a sense of, you know, and there's no medicines involved. We're just talking. So right. You get a sense of, I easily pick up an altered state. I'm fluid. I move easily between states.
Right. And as Christopher Bach said, and you quote him in the book, states of consciousness are contagious, which speaks to the value and the power of having an experienced psychedelic guide.
That's exactly right.
You know, we know, those of us that have done heroic doses of psychedelics,
yes,
know about the dissolving of the ego, and that's kind of one way of defining a mystical experience, because your consciousness just expands beyond,
yes,
you know, this bag of skin. But you make the point that the mystical experience, which is so highly valued in the medicalization of psychedelics, may not be the sole key to the therapeutic benefits of entheogens, and I'm quoting you here. Instead, it might be the confrontation with death that is the actual mechanism of transformation. The acceptance of our mortality, along with the sense that something about us is eternal. Wow, that's very spiritual. I don't know why, you know, the scientific community or the academic research teams can't embrace that. But so you're talking about the death of the ego gives us, it's kind of a near-death experience, sort of.
Yes, sort of, yeah. It's, if people want to look it up, it's the NYU team using psilocybin with terminal cancer patients are working with this dying before you die and helping people accept their own death and make the most of the time they have left. So that's where that's happening.
Yeah, and you quote Carl Jung, who said, quote, death should be seen as a goal rather than an end. And he designated the latter part of life as life toward death. What an interesting distinction, a goal rather than an end.
Yeah.
So that's sort of implying that it's not the end. How is it a goal? How is death a goal?
Well, we all want to have a good death. I mean, I think that is the goal that most of us share. But and so what is a good death? How do we each define a good death?
Right.
So I think that's and to face death with some kind of adventurous spirit. We don't really know what happens after.
Right. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah, I just was looking at a quote from your book, and it goes, this is going back to the fact that I took it without a guide. You say, not always journeying with a guide is, yes, heretical. I thought, oh my God, I'm a heretic. But
pretty much. Yeah.
That's hilarious. But that's according to you, right? I mean, all right.
It's also according to the tradition from the
indigenous. Right. And I think your experience. Right. And your experience was very traditional. You've always had a guide or a shaman, looking out for you.
Let me just challenge you a minute. Did you read did you notice the part where I talked about Zoom ceremonies with Peruvian shaman where I didn't drink the medicine? I was on Zoom. The shaman were in Peru. They drank the medicine.
Right.
And sang over Zoom. And I could feel the energetic healing and cleaning out. And it really helped me get over a very tough major abdominal surgery that I had. This was during COVID. I experienced this. And I did ceremonies with them about once a month during my recovery.
Where you weren't taking any medicine, but you were just
no medicine for me. And some of the tribal traditions, only the shaman drinks the medicine, the patients don't.
Right.
So this is the whole different thing. Right.
Right. You point out that the shadow can come up, that, contents of the subconscious that are unpleasant can happen. Why is that good for us? Is that kind of like a purging, a mental purging? Because you talk
hopefully.
About, yeah.
Yeah, hope, talk about,
yeah.
It's an opportunity to work through some things, but that means working on it after the ceremony. When these kinds of unforeseen, uncomfortable things come up, they can be also re-traumatizing. So some people recover memories of trauma or abuse that they didn't even remember.
Right.
And so that really requires therapy after the ceremony.
Yeah, no, I think I would recommend that people have a therapist if they're going to do this kind of work. Wow, there's so much more that we could talk about. And I want to mention the fact that this show is going to be broadcast sometime in the next month or so from this recording, and you're doing an event here in Portland. Actually, I'm not in Portland right now, but the show is broadcast in Oregon. Tell us about that event briefly.
Well, it's July 20, and it's at the famous Powell's Bookstore, so I'm excited to go there.
Oh, yeah. That'll be fun. Well, I want to say thank you, Rachel. There's so much more we could explore, but we have run out of time, amazingly. I mean, it went so fast. It's just a fascinating book, and I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is named after the book, www.swimminginthesacred.com. Swimminginthesacred, all one word, .com. And for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late this time, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play or share this interview that we did today whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I will tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Dr. Rachel Harris, author of Swimming in the Sacred, Wisdom from the Psychedelic Underground, a fascinating book I highly recommend. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning by Donald Altman or myself at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. But even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's divination.com, as well as via iTunes, Paulo's YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Rachel Harris and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Portland, full strength community radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with